Today, we are looking at a local mechanism taxonomy of anomalous material responses, focusing on the stakes of getting the physics correct. If we don't apply precise labels to these phenomena, we miss the actual physical mechanisms at play. We are the armchair physicists, and our mission is to map out exactly how different materials respond to anomalous field environments.
Yeah, and to do this accurately, we really have to recognize that these breakdown mechanisms differ drastically from one another, but they all sit under this broader field-coupled or electrodynamic class.
Okay, so one single field environment is going to couple very differently into structural steel than it does into, say, concrete, or into vehicles.
Yeah, or even contact interfaces and moisture-bearing material. The physical response you get, it depends entirely on the fundamental properties of the material itself.
Before we map out the specific field effects, we should contrast this with the standard expectation, which is generally what we call Model A.
Model A relies exclusively on ordinary gravity, standard fire, and mechanical impact to explain destruction.
Fire and gravity-driven crush models cannot mathematically close the ledger for the combination of fines, ultrafines, lofting, steel section loss, selective heating, a thermal deformation, and collateral patterns all occurring together. And it has to try and close the energy and mass ledgers together under a strictly closed gravitational budget.
Which is incredibly tight. Gravity provides approximately 2.05 kilojoules per kilogram of kinetic energy. That is a hard limit.
You literally cannot spend more energy crushing concrete than the gravity of the falling mass provides.
So because that budget is so strict, getting the physical mechanisms right is absolutely critical. We'll follow a specific analytical pattern for the rest of our discussion to navigate this.
Okay, so for the listener, we aren't trying to prove an entire architectural case today. We are just reading the carried mechanism signatures left behind in the physical evidence.
Yeah, we are. So for each mechanism, we'll establish the normal state of the material. Then we look at the field interaction, followed by the material change, the visible phenotype that results, a physical example, and finally, the limit or guardrail for that label.
Let us unpack the first branch, which specifically handles mixed materials and metals. The acronym is IMD.
That stands for interferometric molecular dissociation. The physics here are driven by that term, interferometric.
Meaning when anomalous fields overlap in space, their phase differences, gradients, or standing wave patterns create distinct high and low coupling zones.
But that creates a highly structured, non-uniform energy environment. And for you listening, we will do a dedicated geometry explainer on how those interference patterns map out in a different discussion.
So looking at the normal state, ordinary matter, whether we are talking about atoms in a steel lattice or mineral grains, is held together by electromagnetic bonds.
Its physical strength requires those bonds, structural boundaries, defects, and interfaces to remain completely coherent. If the bonds hold, the steel beam remains a solid steel beam.
But under IMD, the field interaction causes bond decohesion.
Yeah, a field disturbance basically weakens the electromagnetic bonds and interfaces. It weakens them to the point that a patch of material simply stops acting like one solid piece.
And we need to emphasize that IMD is not steel melting from high heat. And it's not steel being crushed into smaller pieces by mechanical force.
No, it's dissociation operating locally at the lattice level.
Okay, let's unpack this. If we observe a massive structure turning into fine particulate, how do we definitively know it isn't just ordinary crushing? Gravity provides a tremendous amount of mechanical force.
Well, in any ordinary crushing scenario, the hammer must remain physically solid to perform compressive work on the anvil. The kinetic energy of a falling steel block crushes the concrete below it.
But the evidence here shows something else.
It shows the hammer itself dissolving into fine particulate midair, long before it can strike the ground or the floor below.
You cannot use a hammer to crush an anvil if the hammer fundamentally loses its structural coherence and turns to dust during its swing.
Yeah, the mechanical ability to do work is completely lost before the crushing can actually happen.
Which brings us directly to the visible phenotypes, because the physical evidence left behind is highly specific.
We see steel and core fading, where the structure loses its coherence while still standing. It just enters the fine particulate ledger, or the missing section ledger.
We also see section thinning. That's where the cross-section of a steel member loses massive amounts of material without any visible slag or liquid runoff that would indicate bulk melting.
We also document internal voiding. That's when pores or cavities form deep inside the steel member, entirely separate from the outer surface.
We also observe curled, thin remnants where the weakened edges of a steel beam deform smoothly after section loss.
And critically, we see prekinetic facade fines. mixed source particulate emerges and billows out before gravity can even do the mechanical work to fund its creation.
So the dust exists before the kinetic energy is even spent?
Yeah, it does.
We have to move carefully at this junction and separate interferometric molecular dissociation, or IMD, from our next category.
IMD handles mixed materials and metals, but dielectrics require a completely different analytical lens.
They do. For dielectrics, the operative mechanism is Coulomb-type fragmentation, sometimes called dielectric saturation.
In their normal state, materials like structural concrete, masonry, and ceramics act as dielectrics. They are essentially insulators.
Because they do not conduct electricity well, the internal energy dynamics change completely when subjected to a field environment.
Rather than conducting a current smoothly, the field interaction forces electric charge to separate or accumulate right across microscopic pores or internal moisture films.
Yeah, or aggregate boundaries and contact interfaces within the concrete itself.
So what happens when that internal electrical stress exceeds the material's inherent tensile strength?
The material structurally fails from the inside out. Concrete has high compressive strength, but very low tensile strength. So it fractures into tiny fragments or fine particulate because it is literally being pulled apart.
Visually, that phenotype is highly distinct from mechanical crushing.
It is. The individual mineral grains are pulled away from each other by internal charge stress, rather than being externally crushed together by a compressive load.
And the physical data rigorously supports this specific dielectric mechanism. We see massive amounts of dielectric side fines and an ultrafine mineral fraction measured in the 0.09 to 0.26 micrometers range.
For you to visualize that, particles that small are a fraction of the width of a human hair.
Grinding solid rock down to that submicron scale requires an astronomical amount of energy. It far exceeds that strict 2.05 kilojoules per kilogram gravitational budget we discussed earlier. Gravity simply cannot afford to make dust that fine.
But we must establish a strict limit here. We do not use Coulomb-type fragmentation as a blanket label for every single instance of dust or structural failure.
It is highly specific to these dielectric behaviors.
Yeah, it must be strictly supported by the speciation of the dust.
Yep.
If the dust is composed of primary building material phases at that submicron scale, rather than just soot from a fire, then this branch applies.
Once that massive volume of fine material is created, we have to explain how it behaves in the environment, which is highly anomalous.
This brings us to dielectrophoresis, or DEP. And we need to separate this concept entirely from the actual breakup of the material.
So DEP does not create the dust. It acts upon it.
Yeah. Dielectrophoresis involves non-uniform electric fields acting on polarizable particles or bodies. The field interaction creates a distinct vector force that pushes or pulls these polarizable particles along the field gradients.
And if the field gradient force is strong enough to beat gravity, aerodynamic drag, or normal settling behaviors, you get a highly unusual phenotype.
You do. It can lift, sort, or vector already formed fine material. And we see this documented directly in the physical evidence.
Like the fine dust continuously rising around the feet of pedestrians walking through the area.
Or the ground plane lofting at locations like Murray and West Streets. The dust hangs thickly in the air and moves laterally without any obvious thermal buoyancy or visible steam to lift it.
If a massive underground fire were creating thermal updrafts strong enough to lift that volume of dust, spraying water on it should produce massive columns of visible steam.
But the profound lack of steam indicates a lack of severe bulk heat at the surface, meaning the lift mechanism is strictly non-buoyant.
Let me ask a clarifying question here about the origin of the dust for you listening. If DEP is just acting as the elevator, lifting this dust up and floating it down the street, what actually built the dust in the first place?
DEP is merely the lift and sorting mechanism. It's not the main fines production engine. The engines doing the actual destruction are the IMD and Coulomb type fragmentation we just discussed. Those electrodynamic mechanisms do the immense work of breaking the solid material down. DEP simply acts on the resulting particulate.
Moving from the behavior of dust back to the behavior of metals, we have specific mechanisms that account for conductor side anomalies, particularly what we see in the surrounding vehicles.
First is electron cyclotron resonance, or ECR. Then we have conductive loop coupling, which is CLC, and selective impedance heating, or SIH.
Let's start with ECR.
ECR mechanics handle metal side selective absorption. The basic physics here involve electron motion coupling highly efficiently with the anomalous field under specific earned conditions.
And when this localized resonance occurs, we observe the presence of iron-rich spheres.
Yeah, that indicates localized, intense steel heating sufficient to melt iron and allow surface tension to pull it into microscopic spheres without burning the surrounding material.
We also see rapid, unnatural oxidation and the failure of chemical passivation.
The steel's natural resistance to rapid rusting is stripped away almost instantly, leaving thick, anomalous rust layers.
Then conductive loop coupling, or CLC, and selective impedance heating, or SIH, explain how this electrodynamic energy travels through macroscopic structures.
Induced currents are routed preferentially through highly conductive metal paths. Conductors heat internally from the resistance, while low-loss dielectrics stay completely spared.
We tie this directly to the West Broadway vehicle cluster and the specific conductor damage seen on vehicles like car 2723.
We document vehicles with severe, isolated metal damage. We see perforated transmission humps and completely missing engine blocks.
But they have completely spared nylon seat belts, unburnt cloth upholstery, intact dashboard plastics, uncharred paper, and even green foliage sitting just inches away.
A conventional, thermally driven fire would ignite the paper and melt the plastics long before it could do that kind of structural melting damage to the thick steel chassis.
It's a bit like how a microwave heats up a damp sponge but leaves the glass plate it's sitting on completely cool. The energy specifically routes into certain pathways and ignores the low-loss materials.
That material's selectivity is the exact hallmark of SIH. However, we must apply a firm guardrail here. Electron cyclotron resonance, or ECR, is not a default label for every single vehicle anomaly we find.
Conductive loop coupling, or CLC, and selective impedance heating, or SIH, are the primary drivers for the conductor side vehicle heating.
Yeah, ECR is strictly reserved for cases where that specific resonance argument is mathematically earned by the physical presence of those iron-rich spheres.
Beyond localized heating, we also see massive, large-scale structural deformation that completely defies standard mechanics. That brings us to our final branches, a thermal plasticity and interface response.
Normal plasticity means a metal bends through dislocation motion. For a massive structural steel beam to bend smoothly without cracking, it usually requires immense mechanical force.
Or extreme bulk heat like you would find in a foundry furnace.
Or a combination of both, yeah. The steel lattice must be physically bullied into a new shape, or heated until the entire volume becomes pliable.
But the carried picture suggests that field or interface effects lower the resistance to deformation or bonding entirely.
This mobilizes lattice defects, grain boundaries, or contact interfaces, allowing them to slide and reorganize without ever reaching furnace-level temperatures.
We tie this to massive steel box columns exhibiting smooth, sweeping curls.
And wrong axis deformation, where heavy I-beams bend smoothly around their vertical strong axis rather than buckling along their weaker horizontal axis.
Gravity only pulls straight down. So finding a heavy I-beam bent into a smooth semicircle around its vertical strong axis means we are looking at a completely different non-axial torque history.
We also see profound interface anomalies where vastly different materials bond seamlessly without any bulk melting occurring, like the fused paper and steel filing cabinet artifact.
Delicate paper cellulose is physically embedded within a fused ferrous metal matrix, yet the paper fibers remain legible and entirely uncharred.
We also see the fused coin cluster, where zinc pennies and copper nickel coins are bonded together. Zinc melts at roughly 420 degrees Celsius, which is much lower than the melting point of the copper nickel alloys.
In any normal thermal fire capable of softening the copper, the zinc would slump, melt, and flow away like a liquid brazing metal.
But here, the low melting point geometry is perfectly preserved without any bulk flow. We even see the meteorite paper and metal interface exhibiting this exact same thermal preservation.
I should point out for you listening, reading these specific artifacts does not provide a full architectural proof of the entire event on its own.
No, it provides a highly specific mechanism signature.
This strictly split taxonomy matters immensely for the integrity of the analysis. Applying the wrong labels weakens the entire case, because these mechanisms do entirely different physical jobs.
Yeah, each branch must perfectly match the material type in question, the scale of the observation, the specific timing, and the collateral damage pattern surrounding it.
You simply cannot swap a dielectric breakup mechanism into a conductive heating problem.
To recap the specific jobs these mechanisms perform, IMD is responsible for lattice decohesion, section loss, and finds dominant material loss across mixed materials and metals.
Coulomb-type fragmentation strictly accounts for dielectric breakup. tearing apart insulating concrete and masonry from the inside out.
DEP provides the dielectrophoretic lift and sorting. Electron cyclotron resonance, or ECR, conductive loop coupling, or CLC, and selective impedance heating, or SIH, are the primary drivers for the conductor side vehicle heating.
And finally, a thermal plasticity accounts for non-bulk thermal deformation and bonding,
which allows massive steel beams to bend smoothly on the wrong axis and dissimilar materials to fuse together without charring.
From the Armchair Physicist, thank you for joining us as we map this out.